Interview with Don Nicolaisen, December 10, 2010, in Aiken, South Carolina, by Kenneth Durr. Interesting thing, I noticed that your father was an accountant, so you grew up with this stuff. Is that right?
I did. He was an accountant. He had not, he was not a university graduate, so he learned it the hard way. I was convinced when I went to school that there was one thing I wasn't going to do, and that was accounting. So I ended up being a major in economics and psychology, and saw that the job opportunities weren't great in my senior year, and took a lot of accounting credits. I actually like it.
Yeah, it sounds like economics and psychology would lead, you know, pretty clearly into that line of work.
It does, and the psychology is probably more important than the accounting when you deal with the audit practice, which is where I spent much of my career.
Tell me a little bit about joining up with Price Waterhouse in the 60s. What was the firm like? What was your job?
Well, the firm was relatively small at that time, as were all of the then Big Eight firms. I interviewed with all of the Big Eight and concluded that I liked Price Waterhouse primarily because of the people I met and the clients that they had in the office where I started, which was Milwaukee, Wisconsin. So it was a great list of clients, nice people, and a good opportunity to begin a career with the opportunities to do other things. So my thought process was I would spend a couple of years at Price Waterhouse and then move on and do something else. As things happen, I spent a lot more than that there.
How about specialty? Do you become a jack of all trades when you first start out, or how does that work?
Well, you start out with a broad cross section of clients. So my first client was a public utility, followed by a mortgage bank, and then a very large manufacturing company. And so great diversity of work at that time. Today it's a little more specialized, but at that time you could really do a cross-section of clients. And that was part of the appeal. It was always interesting. There was always something different. So I began in the audit practice, thought about moving into either consulting or tax, but with the variety of things that you could do in audit, just loved it and stayed.
Maybe something to do with that psychology too.
Perhaps.
Tell me about moving up. Did you go from Milwaukee to another big city, larger city, or how did that work?
Well, after 3 years in Milwaukee, I was asked if I would be interested in participating in what was then their international exchange program at PW, and it was really, as they called it, the grooming school, or to help you acquire additional polish, if you may. The opportunities were all in Europe. My first reaction was, I like Milwaukee and probably wouldn't do it, but let me talk to my wife. And she was very enthusiastic about it right away. So we pursued it and ended up after 3.5 years in Milwaukee, then spending the next 3 years in Hamburg, Germany.
Now, that would seem strange because, you know, you're in the U.S. and you're working according to GAAP, I guess. And then all of a sudden, in order to sort of polish you, they sent you off where things are completely different?
They're very different. The language, of course, is the biggest difference. But accounting-wise, many of the clients were U.S.-based. So I worked on companies that were today Exxon's and W.R. Grace and Kellogg and other household name U.S. companies, as well as Royal Dutch Shell, and it was primarily the German affiliates of those companies.
Okay. So they were all using GAP.
They were all using GAP. They all spoke German.
I suppose you spoke German after a while.
And all my staff spoke German, so I had to learn very, very much on the fly how to communicate. And that was a great opportunity, too. You really did. You were exposed to the cultural differences, the language differences, but while my focus was primarily on U.S. GAP for these companies, you also were deeply involved in their statutory reporting, and I learned a lot about financial reporting in Germany and how it works, and it actually became a real interest to me because it was so different from U.S. GAP.
In what way?
Everything in Germany at that time was driven by rules and regulations. So there wasn't use of principles, which we had at that time in the U.S. The focus was instead on compliance with laws and regulations, and disclosures were very specific. If the disclosure was required, it was provided whether the amounts were material or totally immaterial. And the structure of the balance sheet was very different. The balance sheet had a long-term focus to it, contrasted to the U.S., which looked primarily at short-term influences first.
Hmm. So you came back to the United States. Did you go back to Milwaukee?
I did. Came back to Milwaukee. We spent, probably another dozen years there, and then off to New York.
Okay. What was the move to New York about?
I was asked to head up the national office functions, the accounting, auditing, SEC practices.
Okay.
All of the technical aspects of that.
What does that entail? Unpack that a little bit.
Well, a little bit. It's the place where ultimately partners would have to go if they had a decision that they needed help with, as far as either accounting or auditing for their clients. It's the place where the firms interface with the SEC and the FASB. So, spend a lot of time working with and discussing issues with your counterparts at the SEC, the other accounting firms, and the FASB. And then I spent as part of that, I spent 8 years on the Emerging Issues Task Force of the FASB.
Right. Well, let's talk a little bit about the people you worked with at the SEC along the way. You go to the chief accountant a good bit.
Yes. While I was, you did. Naturally, you tried to help each other. I think that's one thing people maybe don't understand about the profession, is that there's no intent to surprise people or trap people. The idea is communicate as openly as possible. Were client issues, where we had client issues and there were simply no answers, I always thought it best practice to explain beforehand why we were reaching conclusions that we were reaching. And so as long as the client didn't disagree, we would often entail visits down to the SEC, particularly the chief accountant's office, to explain this unique set of circumstances. And that dialogue sometimes would be easy, where the SEC would say, we get it, we have no better answer. In other cases, they had seen practice elsewhere, and we had an opportunity then to get to the appropriate response. So a real good exchange of ideas.
Did the people in that position, the chief accountants, did that make a difference in how they handled situations like this?
Well, I think for them, it's also the learning experience, which I learned later on when I was at the office, is that it provided them an opportunity to see much more than they would if people didn't communicate and didn't open the kimono, if you will, and show the issues that are really current today and that companies were troubled by.
This was the 80s and 90s.
This was the 80s, late 80s and 90s.
Okay. What were some of the issues? I would assume that there were a few issues that kept coming up.
About probably 80% of the issues were related to financial instruments, how to account for complicated hedging transactions, the whole area of financial structure and spin-off of entities and the separate off-balance sheet and on-balance sheet transactions, securitizations, all of those things that were evolving in that time period were basically the heart of what we discussed.
Okay, so you were there when these things were really coming up.
Yes.
That would... Someday everybody would know what those things
were. That's right.
Were you working with the SEC? Were you kind of doing an ad hoc structuring, the body of principles, the way you'd work with these things? And was the FASB involved in that discussion?
Yes, the FASB was usually involved in the discussion. And many of the issues would end up at the Emerging Issues Task Force. So it was all of the firms would float those things that were really new or unique, or it wasn't clear how to account for it, or you could analogize to one direction would give you one answer, analogize to some other transaction gives you a different answer. And so I think it was a period of time of a lot of openness, a lot of discussion, a lot of exploration as to how do you deal with these derivatives and securitizations and other complex financial structures?
Who did you work with on the EITF?
Oh, the EITF was is the FASB, of course. Right. So their board members and staff would all participate.
And other industry people, too, right?
Yeah, industry people primarily. The participants on the EITF itself were primarily the accounting firms, all of the large firms, plus several of the regional firms, as well as a number of people from industry. Industries were probably not as directly financial industries as the issues were. So you'd have people with backgrounds in accounting, but they were all from, they might have been from manufacturing or other areas as well. So good cross-section, good discussions. All of that was open to the press, was open to the public. So others who wanted to comment on it were encouraged to do so. And the SEC's chief accountant would sit in on all of those discussions at the EITF.
Right. I was told that he had the power of, what was the power? The power to stand up and say whatever he wanted to say, right?
Had the power to say whatever he wanted to say. That, obviously, that power was limited to, in the sense that he didn't speak for the commission itself. It was a personal expression of opinion. But needless to say, carried great weight.
Right. Did people from the accounting firms tend to get on the EITF and stay there for long periods of time? People who tended to have that perspective?
Yes. I'd say I was probably one of the longer-term members, 8 years, and some people might spend 4 or 5. But generally the idea was to continuity did matter.
It didn't matter.
It did matter. Yes, it did.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay. So Pricewaterhouse was probably pretty happy to have somebody that they could count on being there.
Right. Right.
Moving up, were you involved in the merger with Coopers and Librand?
Yes. At that point, I chaired the financial services practice at Pricewaterhouse, insurance, brokerage, banking, and other areas, and was a member of the board, the Pricewaterhouse board, both in the U.S. and globally, mm-hmm. and so was deeply involved in those discussions. I chaired at both levels the human capital committees, which meant had to deal with partnership issues, partner concerns, compensation, and admission of new partners, and a lot of other things. So, yes, I was involved.
Was this the latest in a long line of acquisitions for Pricewaterhouse?
No, Pricewaterhouse historically did not do acquisitions. They were very rare in the time that I was in the firm. It was not at all common for PW to do mergers. So this was a very big step for us as a firm. We picked our partner carefully and did a lot of work before we shook hands and agreed to move forward.
Did Coopers pick you too? I mean, was it mutual?
I think it was mutual. Like anything else, it takes a little while to get to know each other, even though you know everything about each other and their clients. It's different to sit down over the table and reach agreement on things that matter.
Right.
But clearly the fact that everyone is structured as partnerships makes it easier because you realize how important it is that you can rely upon your partners, and so the level of trust has to be developed very quickly. And it wasn't as difficult as I might have imagined.
Yeah. I want to get a sense of what's going on at this time and what was driving you to this merger. I mean, the other firms are doing more or less the same thing, I guess. But how much, from your perspective, how much was internal, the logic of Pricewaterhouse, and how much was just external? We've got to do this because the world around us is changing.
I would say if you have something that's working, it's always easier to say, let's leave it as it is and we'll continue our own practice. So that obviously is the difficulty in reaching a conclusion to merge with somebody else. But when you looked at the global reach that it offered, the really balancing of clients across industries and the ability to develop deeper skill sets to better serve your clients, to look at the economies of scale that come with that size of a merger, the balancing within other parts of the globe of our practices was very complementary, and the more we looked at it, the more I think both parties agreed that this was a very good merger and well worth pursuing.
Economies of scale is pretty clear, you know.
Right.
What was Coopers bringing geographically or in terms of practice that Pricewaterhouse didn't have?
They had a very good practice in parts of Europe. We had a very good practice too, but they had a very complementary practice. PW historically had served the largest companies in the world, and Cooper certainly had very large clients, but they also had a much broader range of midsize and smaller clientele.
Okay.
And in particularly Germany and other places, they just had excellent practices that were very complimentary.
Okay. Well, by the 90s then, you've got, your perspective is undoubtedly a lot broader than when you were hanging around in Milwaukee. You're meeting with the FASB, the SEC. By the late 90s, Arthur Levitt's sort of pushing some accounting reforms at the right. SEC. What was Pricewaterhouse's perspective on that? How did the industry or the profession receive those initiatives by Levitt?
Well, I think obviously it's always difficult when somebody from the outside critiques your whatever it is you're doing, and those are generally viewed as the critics. It doesn't matter. I don't think whether you're a playwright or an actor or a politician or anybody else, you want to naturally defend your own practices. But there was good reason to address a number of areas of independence, of just better communicate with the public, particularly the investing public, what the firms were about, what they can and can do, and can do very well, as well as why, what steps are in place to protect independence and objectivity, and being able to assure investors that the focus is on an audit and that the audit is done right. So.
Right.
In balance, I think that dialogue and that sort of pressure is very helpful. It's good to have.
But my sense is that in the late 90s, the profession wasn't as open to making changes as it later became.
No, obviously it wasn't. We had been very successful. I think whenever that happens, there's always a swagger that large institutions that achieve substantial success tend to have. And I don't think we were unique in that sense. And we felt very strongly we were doing most things right. Mm-hmm. And certainly all the big things. But the appearance side of it needed some help.
Did you interface with the Public Oversight Board at any point? Or was that really more?
I didn't do too much. I did a little bit, the old original Public Oversight
right.
Board. I did a little bit, but it wasn't a big occupier of time for me.
Okay. Any other FASB EITF initiatives in this period that we haven't talked about that kept you busy?
Well, I think with the financial instruments and the consolidation questions, we were very busy. And, of course, this was also a period of time where stock option accounting was proposed for change, ended up with enough pressure from Congress that the FASB did not act at that time and planted some important, for me was important because later when I was at the commission we really did have to deal with that and had a different result.
Right. Okay. Well, you talk about the swagger, and by the early 2000s the swagger is undoubtedly a bit less pronounced.
A little more wobbly.
Yeah. Did you and your colleagues have a sense of the public perception of the profession in the early 2000s?
I think that obviously varied. Where if you looked at the 95%, it was done right. There weren't really issues. If you look at the fringe areas where there was very bad accounting, very bad auditing. I think there's no excuse for that, and with reasonableness, I think all of the firms recognized that this is an urgent matter, and we really need to deal with it and need to change. And there was a response that followed, some of which, of course, was overtaken by events, Sarbanes-Oxley clearly being the biggest change instrument. But there was a lot that happened. From a personal perspective, it's probably the first time in my career where I was deeply disappointed that our profession would be perceived as having significant failures, significant gaps in what we did and lapses. And while I was proud of our partners and our firm, the noise around the industry was extremely disturbing.
You talked about some initiatives that were taken prior to Sarbanes-Oxley that obviously people forgot about because they, it was this earthquake. What were some of those?
Well, there were a number of changes made in independence and objectivity and required review processes, so more things moved to the national office, oversight, changes in accounting, unique transactions, the troublesome practice areas that were pretty apparent to everybody, consolidation issues, all of those things, securitizations, all those things, took on even more of a national office focus and decisions tend to be gathered there rather than at the individual practice partner level.
Gotcha. Was this common across all the big firms?
I think so, yes. Okay. I think all of them.
And without naming names, and there were five at that point, I guess, without naming names, did different firms take different approaches to this? Were some a little more intransigent and others more attuned to...
Well, I think all of the firms, obviously Arthur Andersen was very much on their back foot and were in the papers every day, and the images of the Enron situation, the destroying of documents or shredding of documents, all of that in the eyes of the public and the press are just, was extremely damaging. So I think they were different than the other four firms in that sense. But everyone, I believe, really got the message. And
certainly when the legislation came down.
Right, clearly.
Well, let's move into the SEC period. Tell me a little bit about how you heard about being tapped for the chief accountant's job, why you were told the offer was made, things like that.
Well, I had, in the past, said no to the thought of going down to the commission.
Had the offer been made before?
You know, it's not exactly made. It's will you talk to us is usually the way it works.
Okay. And,
this time was different. I felt very much that if I could play a part, I really wanted to, that I was disappointed in our profession. I was extremely disappointed in parts of the business community. I had to admit that to myself, it was probably more obvious to others, I had to admit to myself that, my background had really prepared me that this was the right time, that I had the right skill sets, and that it would be selfish on my part to simply say no, and realize that it's extremely disruptive to your lifestyle to take an enormous cut in pay, pack up your bags and move to Washington and put on the role of regulatory character as opposed to someone who had always been on the other side of the table. But I felt it was time. Lots of encouragement from Chairman Donaldson and others who were very influential. Alan Beller was the head of corporate finance at the time. Bill McDonough had joined as head of the PCAOB, and all were very encouraging to say, do it, please, you got to.
Were these people you'd worked with in some way before?
Yeah, I hadn't known Alan Beller well. I had met him before that, but he's a very persistent man. He knew what he had to deal with, and he knew how important it was to have a partner in the chief accountant's office that could play a complementary role. And Bill McDonough, I had known for many years from his time at the New York Fed.
Okay.
And so that was a very comfortable position. And I knew I could work with him, that I could trust him and that I could work with him.
Okay. So between the three of you, you're working with Corp Fan and you're working with the PCAOB. Did you have a sense that there was a common agenda? Or did people have different...
Well, the agendas, the objectives were the same. We're all interested in improving investor confidence and putting in place those things that enable them to actually rely upon the work of the SEC and then the PCAOB. PCAOB, of course, was a new creation, and Chairman Donaldson had asked that I be the primary liaison with the PCAOB and work with Bill McDonough in making sure that they got off the ground and providing support from the commission perspective for wherever we possibly could. And so with Bill McDonough's stature and my knowledge of the industry, we soon knew that we could and needed to rely upon each other and conduct a number of different areas. We really worked hard in a lot of areas to get things done and done right.
Did the legislation specify that the chief accountant would be primarily?
The legislation was not that specific. It was that the commission had certain responsibilities, approval of the budget of the PCAOB, as well as what essentially is a second vetting of PCAOB standards, so that the standards would be developed by the staff at the PCAOB and then would be exposed to the public, but then there'd be a second airing of that by the SEC so that the SEC could also gather comments and input. A somewhat complicated structure, but we figured out how we could make it work.
What are the benefits that override the complications?
Well, I think the significance to the PCAOB is that the SEC is well recognized, has the established role of investor protection, had long looked at the auditor relationships and the rules and regulations around auditing, but this provided the PCAOB to leverage that, and where they needed support, the commission was the obvious body to provide that support. So it essentially, for both of us, it really provided more resources and more specialization, if you will, in drilling down on things.
The PCAOB is able to get down into the weeds a little more.
Much more. Yeah. They had a very different charter. This was the first time that the auditing profession was regulated. Their regulator was clearly the PCAOB, and there were very specific elements of that act that the PCAOB had responsibility for, registration and inspection and oversight of the profession.
How about the Office of the Chief Accountant? What did you find when you came in? Was this a pretty well-functioning group, or did you see things you wanted to improve?
Part of that is, let me answer that two ways. One, what I saw I liked. What I also saw, and this is maybe my personality too, is I also saw ways we could do things that I thought would be better. And there had been a shortage of staff. I quickly set out to fill a lot of gaps, created new positions. This was a time where international accounting was also very, very much under discussion, and so I wanted to create a separate function to deal with that, create a separate group that would deal with the PCAOB and the auditing standards, so established deputies in both of those areas. Loved the talent that was at the commission when I came in. Scott Taub had served in filling the void for very long, and had done it very ably.
It was a year or so, wasn't it?
It was at least a year, but he was really the strength of that group for longer than that. And I've just found that he and many of the other staff that were there were just great talent sources, and I didn't have anybody who I was disappointed by. It was a very good impression. The other thing that I found was that, and this may be part of my nature too, is that if I'm part of a large organization, I want to use all the resources of that organization. So I found that the economists, the international group, the various educational aspects that the commission does with investor groups, certainly Alan Beller and I, Alan leading Corp Fin, we were partners immediately. It was really easy. And it was very easy to partner with these other groups within the commission where we could support each other. And I was just blown away by the skill sets and the depth of really quality people that were in many parts of the commission.
But on the other hand, you were looking at expanding the office pretty significantly.
Yes.
So I assume you had to hire a lot of folks.
I did hire a lot, right. We essentially doubled the size quickly.
Did you get a lot of idealistic young people who wanted to get in there and help?
I love those people. Yes, we had lots of those, as well as an amazing number of extremely experienced, high quality candidates who, you know, when you look at their resume and say, wow, this is just unbelievable that this person would even want to contribute at this level, that they're so overqualified. And so it was a tremendous wealth of talent that was available, and it wasn't hard to fill the slots. It was primarily take the time to do it right, get the right people in the right places. But we did that.
Okay, so that's the organizational stuff. The issues.
Let me just add one comment to that.
Sure.
Had from day one the full support of the chairman. And so Chairman Donaldson was very clear that this was an area where he respected my years of experience and abilities. And we really, you know, I really learned how to be useful to him at the same time, to know when I should raise my hand and and make sure that we discuss things. But his support was excellent. As were the other commissioners, but yeah. I'm going to say the chairman stood up.
When working with Bill Donaldson, when was it important to raise your hand?
Well, it was, for me, I thought it would be important, as it is, to make sure that if I took an action that would have significant publicity, mm-hmm. That it would be no surprise across the commission.
Yeah. The least you can do, I guess.
Well, it's kind of more than the least. You know, I would make sure that we'd build up to that, and that there would be a good understanding as to why I would take a decision that I take.
Right. Well, let's talk about the issues that you were faced with. So many things are in flux at this point. Did you sit down and make a list and say, here are my priorities, I've got to hit this first, and then I can hit that, then that?
Yes, and partly because there is nothing that's held that is not subject to public disclosure. I kept those lists in my head. Mm-hmm. So I had a 100-day plan. I knew with real precision what I wanted to accomplish in the first 100 days, and did tick them all off, and did you know, I got it done. Mm-hmm. I also had a pretty good idea of, you know, what would come along the way that would have an element of urgency to it. Had, I think, a pretty good idea of what needed to be done and whether it was accomplishable and within reasonable parameters. What you can't plan for is the day-to-day happenings.
Right.
And they are significant at the commission. There are always events that, as we describe it, where the urgent takes over the important, and you had to work very hard to keep the important things going forward while still dealing with the day-to-day emergencies.
Did you do that by having two sort of sets of staff, one to deal with the emergencies and one to keep?
No, basically a fairly common staff, but having the international group separate from the auditing function and the rest of accounting and reporting disclosure matters made it easier to do that. And so it was pretty clear when something would surface where it would land. Mm-hmm.
Well, let's talk about that 100-day plan. Well, do you remember what was at the top of that list?
Well, staffing was clearly at the top, was to make sure that was commenced and in place, that there was a part of my desire was to make sure that I established relationships on the Hill that would be important as we deal with issues, that I would take the pulse of Sarbanes-Oxley and how it was enacted. A lot of the rules had been written by the commission, but the PCAOB had not yet developed their first standard 404 on internal control reporting. And so while all of that was obvious, it was a time to take the pulse in many areas as to just what I would read as being workable measures and how we might make that happen. Another area that I was deeply interested in was functioning of the FASB and their standard setting process. There were many things that the commission had asked the FASB to deal with, and I wanted to make sure we had a plan in place to track their progress. We didn't have authority over the FASB, but they, like everyone else, were very interested in working so that things got done.
So they didn't mind you tracking their process?
They might have. But I think we did it reasonably cordially.
Well, I'm just going to run through a couple of the sort of themes that come up, and we've talked a little bit about relationships, relations with the PCAOB, and how this was an ongoing thing. Off-balance sheets and special entities,
special purpose
entities. That one seemed to sort of come early and stay late. Tell me a little bit about your experience with that.
Well, that was one that was well underway when I arrived at the commission.
Was there a study going on?
The FASB was in the process of rewriting its standard on special purpose entities. They concluded on an approach that was different, but in my view was also different and complicated. I expressed my views with them, and that was one of the areas where we perhaps didn't have unified idea as to how to deal with it, but it was their responsibility, and you know, I provided the necessary inputs that we could, but at the end of the day, that standard ended up being like many others. It just didn't work. And so,
is that FIN 46?
It was FIN 46 and a couple other interpretations that were provided. They were directionally right, but in practicality of actually making it work in the field, they're extremely complicated for everyone to understand, not just preparers, but investors. And so there still needed to be more work on that. And it was one of the last things when I left the commission and left the inventory of things that were not yet done, that was on my list.
But there was all this talk at this time about standards-based or objectives-based and moving beyond the plethora of rules.
Right.
And my understanding was that FIN 46 was one of these sort of standards-based things.
Anything that's rules-based that enables you to learn how to play the game, and once you know how to play the game, you can circumvent the intent.
Right. Right.
And that's an unfortunate thing. The business community at that time, I think, was really looking for certainty. Tell us the rules, we'll follow the rules. I think they did that in good faith, but at the same time, if there are rigid rules, it's just pretty easy to find a way around it. I've found that from my I said earlier on that when I moved to Germany, we were principles-based,
right.
They were rules-based.
Right.
What we didn't have in absolute clarity, the way the German standards did, was a requirement to explain everything as well as follow the rule. There was also a requirement to explain all kinds of aspects of that. So our increasing movement to more and more standards, more and more details, more and more rules, I'm not a fan of. I understand why we've had to do it, but it, over time, becomes very patchworky, and someone will always find a way to circumvent those rules. And so principles supported by rules works, but rules alone is a problem.
Okay. But FIN 46, was that really rules-based, or was that...
Well, it was really intended to be principle-based with a concept behind it, but the measurements were all mechanical.
Yeah. I suppose people come and ask clarification and these things.
They do, and it is very hard to write a standard that is either principle-based or rule-based that lasts for long periods of time unless it is extremely simple.
Mm-hmm.
And so anything that becomes 50 or more pages is not simple, and we found ourselves in that place.
Okay. Another one that came early and stayed late was dealing with 404.
Right.
And can you walk me through that process and what you were able to accomplish early, and then what the complications became?
Sure. Well, from day one, we knew this would be an extremely controversial implementation process. You would, if you were on the outside looking in and you said, I want to implement something and I want to do it in all companies and do it all at one time, you would say it's impossible. You just wouldn't do it. You'd do test studies, pilot studies. You'd revamp things. You'd moderate it. There would be a lot of steps that you would take along the way. That wasn't really possible with the way the Act was written. So when the PCAOB began to write their rules, their standard on internal control reporting, they were starting with a fresh page with a requirement, and as a new body, you would expect that they would try to do everything possible to fully achieve the maximum in the first step. That was a difficult process. Mm-hmm. So
they did try to do that.
We did work with them as they wrote their rules. There was some moderation along the way, but as it was exposed and it dealt with, I think my feeling at least, was that we're going to have to come back to this, that we're not going to get it done, we're not going to get it completely right in the first phase, that we will require companies to comply with the rule, that we'll look for major departures from it, but that the idea of let's get it out there, let's not go crazy with enforcement in the first year, but let's see if we can't tweak this along the way would be important. So we held hearings, the commission held hearings along the way. Things were moderated. We did ask the PCAOB to make a few changes. In particular, with the smaller companies, it was just within our purview to exclude them until there was enough information available that the tests had been done in the larger companies to be able to say, all right, let's roll this out across those enterprises that aren't as used to this as the largest global organizations.
And don't have the resources
either. Don't have the resources.
So when this was 404 was rolled out, were small companies exempted at that point?
We exempted them. We gave them, we kept revising the calendar to say, not yet.
Okay.
And during that period of time, I searched frantically for ways to simplify the process for smaller companies, to develop a guide, if you will, for a smaller company's implementation of internal control reporting. Asked a lot of different groups to look at it. COSO did. They
COSO?
It's a committee of the Committee of Sponsoring Organizations, I think is the title. Asked them to look at it. They had more views on internal control than any other group, and they were well considered, and they did, and they came back, and the short version is that it's very costly to do in small organizations, mm-hmm. extremely costly, and not sure it passes the cost-benefit test. So right. We thought of other things like labeling, red lettering, that these companies are not in compliance with the requirements. But by the time I left the commission, it was still a non-resolved area.
Right.
Other areas, the PCAOB did their work and really tried hard, I think, to revise, make the revisions that were necessary and appropriate along the way. Many in the business community felt that 404 was overkill, that it was didn't pass any cost-benefit tests, that they had adequate controls. Lots and lots of companies, CFOs and CEOs, would later tell me that when they went through the exercise, they didn't like it. It was very costly, but it was very necessary, and they did benefit from it. And so at this point, it's pretty well baked in the practice, and it's just something that's accepted as you need to have good controls, right, and you need to document those controls.
But at the time, were you seeing sort of some political capital being spent with congressmen coming in and saying, hey, he's up on this because this is too much for our constituents?
Congress was, you know, different people would have different views, and I think I heard from all of those in Congress who were interested in this. Most of them were conveying and expressed it as such, conveying views that they'd heard from their constituents, mm-hmm, as opposed to saying, this is ridiculous, stop it. Mm-hmm. There were a few of those, but they were not by any means the norm. Congress, I think, in passing and enacting the act, clearly knew this would have a lot of controversy associated with it, but it was necessary, and it was fully appropriate in responding to public outcries of outrage, and so for the most part there was pretty good support.
How did you hear from Congress? Were there hearings? Did you ever sit down and testify?
A lot of them would pick up the phone and call. Since I was the identified liaison with the PCAOB, I got the calls.
Right.
And I would meet with both Sarbanes and Oxley and their staff to make sure that they understood what we were doing, how we were implementing the standard, and what oversight we were providing along the way.
Okay. So, did the small business exemption remain then through your time?
It did. Yes. Okay. Yeah, we just couldn't find that magic way to deal with it.
Right. Well, some incidents then, were things that appear from my research have been incidents that sort of have a place and time. One of the first things you did was held an inspection, went in and took a look at the big four accounting firms.
Right.
Tell me a little bit about that process and what you found, whether you were surprised or not.
Well, most of the inspection work was really left with the PCAOB, and I had come from an accounting firm, and I knew pretty much the other firms, so I can't say that I was tremendously surprised. The findings were, by statute, they're not public, so you know, I wouldn't discuss it here either, but mm-hmm, I can't say that I was shocked or surprised significantly.
What was the purpose of that?
Well, the primary of the inspection of the firms, that's required by the Act, by the PCAOB.
But if the findings are confidential, so to speak, I mean,
yes, well, they do. I mean, and we obviously would read the reports and think about things that might impact the reliability of financial reporting, but you know, they are the secondary actors. The primary preparers and primary responsibility for financial statements and disclosures rests with management.
Another one is the contingent fees. You got into a little scuffle with KPMG about contingent fees.
Yeah, I would say it wasn't just KPMG. There were a number of contingent fees are not permitted and never have been. And so the firm couldn't say, our fee is this, but if this happens, you know, it's 10 times that. But there were shortcuts, I'd call them shortcuts. They were well thought out, well lawyered, that had been looked at as ways to achieve, particularly in the tax area, where additional results would increase the bottom line for the company, that there'd be some sharing of that along the way. And
was this new, or had this been around for a long time?
It had been around for a while, but it was beginning to grow in size. And so I maybe, perhaps dogmatically, just said, stop it. This doesn't pass the appearance of independence, in my view. My view isn't the only view, but I just couldn't, from a public standpoint, not express a view on it. So,
how did you do that? Through a release or something?
I called each of the firms in and talked to them, and then issued a release.
Okay.
A statement, I guess, is actually what it was.
Okay. How was that received?
I wasn't greeted with open arms, but I think the majority of people understood that, you know, it needed to be addressed, and that there were not logical ways to conclude other than don't do contingent fees.
Now, at this point, were the accounting firms, I mean, were they making the case that, well, you know, we're not doing our consulting now, you know, we're under a lot of pressure here to make money, you know, to survive. Did they make that argument?
That wouldn't be a good argument for them to make, but they.
Why not?
Because it's a question of, is this particular approach appropriate or not?
Right.
And so I don't. You know, while there might have been some noise around that, that wasn't the primary argument. The arguments were lawyerly; they were scholarly. They had sliced and diced every word that was out there. They had looked at everything that existed, and they felt, with confidence of their lawyers, that they had, you know, that they were fully within their rights and appropriately dealing with it, and had appropriately put safeguards around it. Mm-hmm. And a lot of that, you know, I didn't disagree with. I just think the perception was so inconsistent with the independence of an auditor that I just, for me, it ended up being, and I'll say again, it was dogmatic on my part. I just decided that I would put my stake in the ground on it.
Did that work?
Yes.
And then a big one, Fannie Mae, late 2004. They were asked to restate, is the way I...
Yes.
Tell me about the process leading up to that.
Well, Fannie Mae was not required to register with the SEC. By law, you know, by statute, it wasn't a requirement, but for good reason decided to do that. And so in doing so, they came to the commission and they said, we want to be treated like any other registrant. We want to file our financial information and statements with the commission, and went through various rounds of preliminary, quote, unofficial filings. And in the course of doing that, in dealing with their own regulator, we were not their regulator. They had a statutory regulator. Their regulator had questioned some of their accounting, and they specifically asked for my views and decision as to what is the appropriate accounting in a couple of areas, the biggest of which was hedge accounting.
Was Treasury their regulator?
No, there's Office OFAO,
okay.
Which has since been renamed something else.
Okay.
But it was a office that was there just for Fannie and Freddie.
I see. Okay. So they asked you your opinion.
They asked for my opinion, and the regulator also did. The company was clear, whatever you decide, you know, we will abide by it. We want to do this right, and we'll comply with it. So I expressed my views after very exhaustive exploration and study of everything that was available. And in my view, it was appropriate for them to restate their financial statements. And that's what I asked them to do. They agreed to do it.
Okay. This would be one of those things you'd make sure Bill Donaldson knew about in advance.
Yes. But, you know, very clearly this was not a commission action, and it was not an action of the commissioners. So all of the commissioners, I tried to keep advised of this, and that there would be plenty of press. But I didn't see any other answer for this. And I'm a believer in what Fannie Mae does, so I like the fact that they were helping people get into homes. I thought it was good for the economy. I think it's good for the stability of families and other things. And so I was not in any view other than to come up with what was right for this very large part of the mortgage economy to enable them to do what they wanted to do, which was comply fully with the SEC's rules and regulations. So
it sounds to me as if, you know, this was just simply you responding to a particular incident. The way it was played up is, you know, this is the SEC flexing its muscle, sort of taking a hardline stand. Everybody stand up and pay attention. Did you know that kind of thing was going to happen, and did that seem like something that maybe was worth happening?
Well, it's in any event, yes, I did, and yes, it's unavoidable, and yes, there were others that should take note of the requirements of hedge accounting. And so that it often in practice often changes. Accounting practices often change when companies read in the newspaper about somebody else having a problem with the SEC. And so I did expect that there'd be others who would also have some issues.
Now, did the SEC or stay in touch as they went through the process?
Oh, yes.
How so? How did that work?
Well, as they worked through their restatement, which took a very long time, my staff and the staff of the Division of Corporation Finance really looked closely at did they do it right? Did they comply? And are the restatements and disclosures, things that we believe are now appropriate. So we stayed with it the whole way.
Another one is lease accounting. You had lease accounting rules, and this would have been toward the end of the period. And
yes.
This is another one that really sort of pops up on
the... It does. It was one that, to me, was an extreme disappointment. My staff had been working with Lease County. They were preparing annually. There's a conference that's sponsored by the AICPA where the SEC staff often summarize events that they've seen in areas that they're concerned about. And it gets the appropriate level of attention at that conference. In preparing for that, they came to me with a couple of leasing transactions that they saw in a number of places where there was no compliance with the existing literature. The literature was the FASB standards were absolutely clear. There was no ambiguity in it. But what had happened is that Company A deviated from the practice, and then Company B, C said, well, me too. And apparently there had been some practice out there of relying upon it being generally accepted as opposed to not in compliance with the accounting standard. This was after we'd finished the first round of 404, and so I had a certain amount of frustration here, believing that if we went through 404, that the starting point for everybody would be, are we in compliance with all accounting literature? And I was extremely disappointed to learn that that was not the case. My view was that it would be best to deal with this as a statement and provide an opportunity for companies to restate and do it collectively so that they're not the outlier and that it could be understood by the investing public that compliance with accounting standards matters. And so I expressed my view on that. I knew it would be extremely unpopular with those companies that didn't follow, that relied upon something other than GAAP. It certainly was not popular with the accounting firms who went through lots of restatements for their clients. But if we're going to have confidence in financial reporting, we need to comply with the rules. And if you choose not to, at a minimum, you should disclose, we don't comply with GAAP. And, this is the reason why. And we've always provided at the commission the opportunity for people to report their own income statement that management can and is encouraged to describe the business as they see it. And if they don't measure it on GAAP, then fine, report it another way as you're in communicating with shareholders, but make sure that the financial statements are right.
Right.
And that you comply with GAAP in those statements, and there's consistency in that. So it was not a popular thing.
It sounds like you put out a statement that essentially said, okay, here's our position. Everybody restate or take charges or whatever.
Right.
Now, essentially.
Exactly. Exactly.
That's what you said. Or did you have any idea of the scope that this thing would be, the number of restates?
No, but I thought it would be quite a few. I think it ended up being more than even I had thought.
Okay.
But I wanted to be fair in the sense of, since it was a fairly broad practice, that it didn't come in piecemeal with one company now, another company later, and the alternative way is to deal with that as an enforcement matter.
Right.
And so you have individual restatements, and the market then begins to wonder, well, what's going on here? And so this was, to me, a fairly simple one. I just said, comply.
Yeah. Having so many companies restating all at once, did that further upset the business at all, or the accounting profession? Or What were the sort of the ripples coming out?
Well, the ripples were, you know, we didn't like it. There are other ways we could have, should have done this. You know, the sort of natural reaction. These are people who I've known for lots of years who get caught up in restating things. So.
Right. Anything else that we should touch on?
You touched on a lot, there? I think. I would say, you know, my I really left with a love affair for the commission, because what it does is so unique. It really does. You wake up every day thinking about the investor community, the strength of our capital markets, the integrity that they have, the fact that there's an enforcement mechanism, that there's really support around providing quality information to investors so that they can make decisions and sleep well at night. It mattered a lot to me, and does today. I mean, I just have great appreciation for the work that the commission does. One of the most surprising things to me was that in the summer, in which Chairman Donaldson announced that I'd be joining the commission, we had a press conference. I got home that evening and played the answering machine, and I was just blown away by people who had lost everything they owned in our capital markets, and that could happen.
So people are giving you a personal phone call.
Personal, please help. Huh. You know, and when it's that personal and that deep and that pervasive, and you look at what happened to the Enron and the WorldComs and the loss of not just capital but retirement plans and employees' lives and aspirations and kids going to college and all these other things that are impacted by it, it hits home how important it is what we do.
Yeah, I don't want to let you go without following up a little bit. A couple years after that, you were on a Blue Ribbon committee created
yes.
by the Treasury Secretary, and you were there with Arthur Levin, I guess.
Right.
This must have been a neat opportunity to come back and take a look a couple of years after, you know, after the fact. Were you surprised by what you saw? Were you pleased by what you saw?
I was. This was not a, remember, this was not an inspection per se.
Yeah,
this is
yeah.
just a take a look at the audit profession, and there were a number of aspects of that. Are there enough participants? Is there enough competition, all of those other things that were important, as well as the quality of the profession. So it was a great opportunity to really take a scrubbing and take a look at what has developed and where the gaps are. And Arthur Levitt and I think, formed a good partnership. We saw things slightly differently, but we were at the end of the day, very much in agreement on the things that could be improved and where progress could be made. And you know, I'm happy that it's out there, that report's out there. The report is being used by the PCAOB as they take action, and it's one of those monitoring steps along the way. So. I'm quite pleased with what we did.
My sense is your recommendations called for really transforming the audit profession pretty significantly. Is that true?
Well, it's called for a number of actions that would strengthen the audit profession. So one of the areas that I think isn't probably widely understood, but the auditor is selected by an audit committee. The audit committee doesn't have any financial information other than what's released unaudited by the firms themselves.
Right.
And so if you just take that little piece and you say it's important that there be a sustainable relationship, and that if you're engaging a major contractor to do something important that can affect the reputation of your own organization, you ought to know quite a bit about that participant. And so that's a gap. And it's things like that we really tried to focus on, is that we believe the profession's acting responsibly and is dealing with many things, but there are real gaps between what they do and what the investing public can understand and verify as to what they do. It's the old Reagan, axiom, trust but verify.
Excellent. Anything else that we should talk about that we haven't touched on?
No, that's a lot.
All right, well, thanks very much.
Thank you.